Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium with a volunteer state twist for week number two here. Bo James joined by Bobby Simmons and Jerry Oates. And how's everybody doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing wonderful. How you guys doing?
Doing great.
Good on this end. It's a gorgeous day, and we're still alive and kicking, so we're doing good.
Yeah, you woke up this morning, right?
Yes, sir. Yes,
that's
sir.
That's a blessing.
Bobby called me the other night, and he said he cannot wait for March to end, and I agree with him because this has been one rough month for all the losses that we've had, and we've had another one. I'll let Bobby tell everybody about it here.
I was saddened to get a call from Scrappy McGowan this week. A lot of people that worked the Georgia territory knew his dad, Charlie. Charlie worked for the office, and he was a timekeeper in Atlanta, and he drove the ring truck for a lot of years, and he was around the matches here and in Florida and a lot of places for a lot of years. Anyway, Charlie McGowan, 96 years old, passed away night before last, and he had a long, full life, and Scrappy was by his side when he took his last breath. They were sitting there talking, and Charlie just, it was time to go, and I was very honored. Scrappy called me, and I went up there and had prayer with the family and was there with them for a while. But another sad loss for those that that knew Charlie, and we feel for Scrappy.
Yep, that's right. Charlie was one fun guy to be around, wasn't he, Bobby?
Yes, he was. He was
a nice man.
He was nice. He was just ornery enough. I told Scrappy the other day, I said, you know, people love Joe Diddy in spite of himself. Me and Randy used to aggravate him unmercifully, and he was good natured, and he took it, and he'd give as good as he took. So he was had a lot of fun with Charlie. I got a chance to go see him last Thursday when he was in the hospital, and talked to him a little bit, and he's gonna be missed.
Was he still sharp, Bobby?
He was sharp as a tack, Jerry. Never lost his sense of humor. He was still very, very alert, very active. Right up, Scrappy said they were talking 5 minutes before he passed away. Said you could understand him, and he was very legible. His kidneys had started failing on him, and he was having some medical issues. But he was very sharp. He when I saw him Thursday morning, he'd lived in a nursing home for about the last 10-12 years. He got to where he would fall a little bit, and he, much like my mother, they couldn't leave him by himself. And Charlie adapted well to his environment and became. They actually had a contest over there to elect the king and queen of the nursing facility where he lived, and Charlie was the king. When I walked in his room the other night, the first thing I saw was this big Jerry Lawler-type crown up over his bed.
He was the king. I'm sure he was the mayor, too.
Yes, sir. I asked him when he was in the hospital. I told him you could actually see the nursing facility from the hospital room he was in, and I said, Charlie, I said, Scrappy tells me you run that place over there. And he goes, I do.
I'm sure he did.
So he pretty well did.
You talk about living a long life, 96 years. He got to see his kids grow up, plus his grandkids grow up. Most people don't get that.
Yeah, he was.
That's for sure.
Charlie had a good life. Had a good life. And his family loved him. I mean, that's, you know. I was glad that when I went up there the other night, I met his roommate, and his roommate was just very upset. But he told me, he said he was just a wonderful guy to be in a room with and to live with, and he said they got along fine. And I was glad Charlie had, even at this late age, had still had a social life, because people just, I mean, the nurses and everybody up there just raved about him.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yep, I'm ready for March to go now.
Yeah.
We've I talked to Michael last night. Michael's doing good. To anybody that might be listening that's concerned about Michael Norris, he's now having to go through the process of the legal end of things with his parents, and it's very time. It's a hurry up and wait type situation, but.
And answer the same questions over and over and over.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hopefully Michael will. He listened to the show last week, and he said tell everybody hello, and maybe if he feels like it, he might be listening tonight. He may call in. I don't know, but Michael's doing well. I would really like to think had I been cast into that same situation, I would have handled it as gracefully as he has, and he's doing good, but. Just keep remembering him, folks. He's still got a long way to go.
Yeah, this March hasn't been kind to him, has it?
Oh, geez. It's just been...
That's the most unbelievable thing I've ever heard.
I mean, we went through... I told him, and then one of the things I told him at church, I said this was a harsh reminder to me of how you can be on the mountaintop. We were just so happy, so... in such a good mood because the reunion had been wonderful. We had had such a great time. And I said, in a matter of him leaving me and us that were there to go home, in a matter of 20 minutes, we went from the heights of being emotionally just at the peak of being happy to the depths of something that I'm not sure we ever hit the bottom of. It was traumatic. And, you got to live life like it's your last day because you just don't know, and you got to enjoy it. And man, tell the people you love them, and don't be bashful about it.
That's it. All we got is right now. We ain't promised the next breath.
Yep. I'll get off my soapbox now. But it was a cruel reminder of just how things can turn around in just a heartbeat. So. You're right, Jerry. I woke up this morning, and I'm very thankful.
I'm telling you, man.
Before you called in, Jerry, me and Bobby were talking about David Allen Coe, the country singer, a true outlaw. He was a big wrestling fan. He used to do all the Great American Bashes for Crockett. He was in a real bad car wreck last week, and I just read a few minutes ago that they sent him home today to recover, so he's out of the woods there. If anybody's listening was a fan of his, everybody knows you make a town with me, you're not going to go too far before you hear David Allen Coe. He's one of my favorite singers, and I got to meet him a few years ago. Just a great guy.
Wonderful.
I saw the pictures of the wreck, and boy, somebody else was riding in the car with him, I can tell you that.
Ooh.
Yeah. There was nothing left. And the man that hit him, they sent him home, but the passenger that was in the other truck is still in the hospital.
Don't ever know.
Yeah, they said that they had to go around a traffic light is what the paper said, and said he got hit by a tractor trailer.
Yeah, it hit him, and then the tractor trailer turned over on its side and then slid up and, I mean, like pinned him up against the light pole.
Jeez.
Yeah. That would be a pretty quick wake-up call there, I believe. You know, matter if you're singing, wrestling, whatever you're doing with the circus, you know, we all live the same lives. I mean, we've all seen those horrible wrecks. Some of us been in a few of them, and it's amazing we ain't lost more boys than wrecks over the years than we have.
Yeah, I've always said that. You're not kidding.
Yeah. I know this is a horrible time for a joke, but I always think of the joke I heard many years ago about the two guys riding in the truck together. And, the guy was giving him an oral quiz, and he says, if you're driving our truck down Pikes Peak and the brakes go out, and you're coming down at the bottom of the hill running 100 mile an hour, no way to gear it down, no brakes, you're coming to a narrow two-lane bridge, and there's another truck jackknife across the bridge in front of you. He said, quick, what's the first thing you're going to do? And the guy goes, well, I'd reach over and wake up my riding buddy over there. And he said, well, what do you mean you're going to wake him up? He said, what are you going to do about the truck? He said, nothing. He said, I just want to wake him up. He said, because he ain't ever seen no wreck like we fixing to have.
That's a fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just, you know. And I know y'all like me, and it, as much as we were on the road, we saw some pretty, I mean, I saw some wrecks, man. I don't know how people walked away from them. Oh.
Yeah, I'm telling you. That picture I saw, the wreck David Allen Coe was in, I mean, he was in a big SUV, and there was very little of it left. It's amazing. So here's another subject. This is one me and Jerry's talked about on here a couple times. I was looking at Facebook yesterday, going down through everybody's posts, just looking, seeing what's going on, and I saw an advertisement for a wrestling card in somewhere in Florida, some town I never heard of this weekend, and they're calling it the Wahoo McDaniels Memorial.
I can tell you who that is. That is the bunch that you know, the table we sat at the reunion.
Yeah.
The table that would be further away from you, to the other side, right there on the end.
Yeah.
That's got something to do with that bunch.
Well, I knew Wahoo. I met him first when I was 15 years old, and I knew him for a long time. And there's no mention of the family. There's no mention of his son. I looked at the pictures. There wasn't one person on this wrestling show that probably even met Wahoo.
Well, he stopped on the side of the road and used the bathroom there one time on the way somewhere to Florida.
I don't know what it is.
It's the biggest house of the year, that little promotion draws. Our friend Mr. Smith has been down there to sell gimmicks that thing. And it's they draw a heck of a house every year, but nobody can figure out why it's the Wahoo McDaniel Memorial.
Yeah, for 5 years here, I did the Brian Hildebrand. Les Thatcher did the Brian Pillman in Cincinnati. I mean, it was a celebration of their lives. Everybody on the card was somebody that knew that person, you know. Same thing with the Ted Allen that we do every year. And we weren't making money off of it because the show we did here went for the Children's Hospital. Les had a charity in Cincinnati. You know, Ted Allen goes for our sunshine. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it just rubs me the wrong way.
Well, I'm like you. I don't understand. I've even questioned, you know, I questioned Charlie. I said, you know, what's the deal? And he said he didn't know either. You know, Charlie just saw a quick buck, and he went down. He was actually on vacation in Panama City, and where they have this thing is a little town about 40, 50 miles from Panama City, and he just went up there and sold his stuff.
I had, when I was running there in 2000, whatever it was, we was going to do a Fred Ward Memorial thing right there in Columbus. Now, you got to remember, my brother was married to his granddaughter at one time. And I knew Fred Ward from the time I was 5 years old. But did you know I called his daughter to ask her, could we do that out of respect for the family?
There you go. That's my whole point right there.
All over it. We had her out there, her husband, his other son-in-law was there. And I brought in guys that had worked for him. Brought Bob Armstrong in. Les Thatcher was there. The superstar was there. I can't remember who else. I was there. Who else? Guys that had actually worked for him. And we made it a nice thing, you know. But I asked the family, could I do that first? And you know, people just... That's like me having a Vern Gagne memorial here in Savannah. Well, first of all, nobody would remember Vern Gagne. And, you know, at least if I was going to do it, I'd call Greg and ask him, would he mind? You know, I mean, it's just respect. There's no more. That's over.
Oh, yeah. It's long gone.
I'm just funny about that. I just have a hard time with that.
Bobby, do you know if they do anything? Do they do anything special for Wahoo? I mean, is it just his name is on it and that's it?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
How many people down there now would remember Wahoo?
Yeah.
Wahoo wasn't from there.
Right. He lived in Charlotte for 30 years. If he was going to do it somewhere, you'd do it around Charlotte.
Exactly.
I'm looking at my chest. I still have handprints. I remember him.
I'm looking at his picture right here, right now. He hangs here in my office with all my friends of the past. I got a wall over here, and It just, I don't know. When I looked at the lineup, and, you know, there was no mention of his son Zach being there or the kid Ricky that used to take Wahoo around that lives in Charlotte. I mean, that the family doesn't even know about it, I would guess.
I'm sure they don't.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing that just irks me about it. It just is. I don't know. I guess they just picked a name out of a hat and said, we'll make the Wahoo. He worked here one time. he came through here. So, and I guarantee you, like, if you were to go through that dressing room and ask them guys, none of them probably knew him, maybe one or two, I don't know, but I would guess none.
Yeah.
And I guess even less of them could tell you anything about his career or his football days or
right.
anything
they
else.
They couldn't tell you. None of them would know he played for the Jets and the Dolphins. No, come on, man, please.
If Charlie happens to call in tonight, he may know more about it than we do. He like I say, he's been there, but I'm not sure where they come up with the name. That was
Now, if Charlie goes over and sells headdresses, I'm done.
Oh, geez.
Maybe that's why he was coming to Cherokee last week.
Let me tell you something. Gene Bennett's got some gimmicks he's selling at these places. I don't know where he got them from, but it's like a hair ribbon thing you put on your hair, and it's got these long, sort of looks like Methuselah or something, and they light up. Now, I don't know if that's considered an Indian headdress or not, but
he'll tell him it is. Tell us exactly
yeah.
what Wahoo used to wear.
Hey Jerry, our buddy here, Bo, worked in Cherokee on the Indian Reservation Sunday. And found out you can get some serious heat by telling the Indians to shut up. This ain't a rain dance.
KC told me, he said, you just shut up. You're going to get us killed. I said, somebody had to say it. They've been waiting for it all day. So, no, I'm going to tell you this. That deal on Cherokee Sunday, I have never worked somewhere that the entire crew was appreciative as the people were towards us. And they stayed after and thanked us for coming to the reservation and thanked us for coming over there and having the matches. I mean, it was a good day.
That's unusual.
Yeah, I mean, we met one of the guys, it's the tribal council. He came in and gave us his card. He, you know, they want to do it again. I mean, they want something over there for the kids, and they were so happy. There was no cussing, nothing vulgar. I mean, it was a family product the way it should be, and they were happy with all the matches and happy with the whole day. So, and they were very leery of having wrestling there, but that once they saw us and they were really happy with it. So I'm hoping we go back three or four times a year now. So it was a lot of fun. Plus they got with it too. You know, I guess they were just happy to see outsiders that were not there trying to take their money at the casino. So, I don't know. Well, I'm going to go ahead and take the first break here. We come back. I've got two pages of questions that people have sent in, and a few of them are mine from all over the country, wanting me to ask Bobby Simmons and Jerry Oates and learn more about their career, because they're always the ones asking the questions. So I got some good stuff here for us, guys. We'll be right back in just 1 minute.
Wrestling fans, Anarchy Wrestling television tapings are the second and fourth Saturdays of every month at 4236 Level Grove Road in Cornelia, Georgia. For more information on Anarchy Wrestling and on the shows, to watch the television product and a whole lot more, go to anarchy-wrestling.net. That's Anarchy Wrestling, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month in Cornelia, Georgia.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Whether you're having an autograph session, personal appearance, or live event, we got just the person you need to contact for all of those needs. SBI Bookings is home of some of the best stars in the wrestling industry today. They provide you with the best talent this business has to offer, from Kevin Nash, Larry Zbysko, Scott Steiner, and many, many more. So who will you contact next time you're planning an event? The men of SBI Bookings. Check them out at sbibookings.com.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first party you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Everybody still with me?
Yes, sir. I just want to clear something up. That girl that does that commercial about the Nasty Anderson brothers and what happened to her in Columbus on her birthday, I took her out to dinner after the matches. Just want to clear that up.
That was
in
nice of you.
I took her to Wendy's, so it probably wasn't an impression.
Yeah.
Well, who was the match guy that was with you then?
Yeah. Took her down on Victory Drive to some of those nice places down there.
Stop it, man, please. You're killing me, Bobby.
All righty.
I took her to Wendy's on Macon Road. I didn't go to Victory Drive. Oh, Lord, I had to get that out. But anyhow, go ahead.
I put out on Facebook a few days ago that I was going to turn the thing around a little bit, interview the two of you this week and ask people to send any questions. And I got questions from people from Savannah, Georgia, all the way to Portland, Oregon. So, and then my wife gave a few today that she wanted to ask, and then I put together some. So we've got quite a few here that maybe we'll share a little more about Bobby and Jerry's career if you're not familiar with them, and without a doubt, it'll be entertaining and educational. So, the first question I got for both of you: memories of your first match.
Go ahead, Bobby.
First match I ever refereed as an official employee of All South Sports, which was Gunkel Enterprises, was in Athens, Georgia, and it was between Larry Hamilton, the Missouri Mauler, and Wayne Cowan. They had a battle royal that night, and the way Tom did a battle royal was as you came out, whoever came out first wrestled who came out second. And I refereed Wayne Cowan and Missouri Mauler. And it was my first match, and it was also the first time I ever seen a pocket knife pulled out of somebody's pocket.
See what you started? You see what you started?
Yeah, it was a...
And I'm sure it was intended for you, right? Not the Mauler.
Well, I don't know. It didn't matter to me. It looked like it was about 12 inches long. I didn't care who it was for. But they were the younger of the Oates brothers was on that card that night. Because I remember he walked in the dressing room, and I was sitting there lacing up boots, and he goes, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm working." He went, "You're kidding." But Ted worked on that show that night. But that was my first one. First one I actually worked was when somebody didn't show up one time in Murphy, North Carolina. I worked a battle royal where I was on the floor and sent guys out. Had the pleasure of rolling in the ring and raising Happy Humphrey's hand.
Did you have to help him get out of the ring?
Oh, geez. Listen, we worked in a Quonset hut at some kind of baseball park in Murphy, North Carolina. It had one 100-watt light bulb over the ring, and Happy Humphrey had to dress at a picnic table in the corner of the building, and they had to string up a, a quilt or a sheet or something up where he could dress behind it because he couldn't fit in the dressing room.
It's stories like this you just cannot make up.
No. You'd like to say, well, my first match was at Madison Square Garden, and you know, but no, that was actually at a Quonset hut in Murphy, North Carolina. But first time as an actual employee was at the J&J Center in Athens.
All right, Jerry, what about your first match?
My first match was March 1970 in Fort Myers, Florida, against Duke Killmucker. And I don't even remember walking to the ring. I was so nervous. It's, you know, growing up as a kid, being a wrestling fan and wanting to do it all your life, and then the time is here, and it's like, now what am I going to do, you know? I mean, I was so nervous. I was scared to death. You know, you wanted to do so good, but anyhow, I got through it all right. And of course, on the way home, all I heard was what I did wrong, not what I did right, which was okay from my brother-in-law. But that's the way we travel. You know, he'd tell me everything I, you know, should have done, you know, and how I should have done it. And that was a great learning experience. I learned as much riding in the car after a match than I did actually in the match. But that was my first match.
That's a good point there. These guys now get in the car and go to sleep. That drives me nuts. So all these big wrestling stars that are out here wrestling now, as soon as they get in the car, they go to sleep. So I tell them, I say, you learn more in the car ride home, not just about wrestling. You learn more about life riding with a bunch of wrestlers than you fix the world's problems than you will anywhere else.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Let me ask you a question, Jerry. When working with Kiyomoka that night, do you kind of remember your body going directions that you really didn't have any reason, or you knew why it was going, you just knew it was going, and you didn't have any choice?
It was that way the whole match.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
You know, Duke been wrestling a long time, and, you know, here I was, my first match, and he wasn't going to go out there and get a broken collarbone dumped on his head. And I understand that. I mean, it wasn't what I would have wanted it to be, but I look back now and I know what he was doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, out there exchanging holes and doing this and doing that, but nothing, you know, nothing where mainly him was going to get hurt or me. But, you know, I learned from that, you know. I wanted to learn.
When you told me who you worked with, and I'd heard you tell that before, I'd never asked that, but I had the privilege of, and it was a privilege for me. I worked with Timmy Gahagan one night, and I know guys hated working with Timmy Gahagan because he was, you know, it was hard to get heat on Timmy. He was just, you know, but I worked with him one night, and I can remember my body. I thought, God, I must really be light on my feet, because I remember doing things that I didn't even know I could do. And I mean, he didn't hurt me. He was very, you know, but I just thought, God, this guy could kill me if he wanted to.
Timmy was something else, wasn't he, Bobby?
Oh, geez.
What's the memories of working in your hometown the first time?
Oh, I'll tell you who you're talking about excited. I had already started in Florida, and the first night in Columbus, Georgia, it was Dickie and I against Fidel Castillo and who was his partner, Bobby? Later with Smirnoff.
Yeah, Alexis Smirnoff, but I don't know I don't remember what he was called.
That's who we wrestled, and I did a move then. I've been wrestling, I don't know, several months then, and we'd come up out of Florida, and we were booked here in Georgia, and I did a hole where the match is rocking along, and I did it with Castillo. We hooked up. He put a hammerlock on me. I reversed the hammerlock, and then I did a head scissor over his back, if you know what I'm talking about. I've only seen one or two guys ever do that, and I've never done it since. And it worked. Do you know what I'm talking about? Instead of coming for him from the front, I come up over his back and head scissored him.
Oh, geez.
Both, you follow me, sir?
I'm here. like the victory roll.
Well, it wasn't a victory roll. It was a head scissor. I head scissored him from the back.
It was a flying head scissor, but you went at him from the back rather than the front.
Right, and took him over the normal way.
Yeah.
I was into a head scissor, but I come over his back and did it.
I got you.
And I've never done it since.
Did you call it that way, or did it just happen?
I don't even know where I got it from. I had to have seen somebody do it. And I figured, well, if they can do it, I can do it. But that's a move I never did again.
Yeah. And the guy was in the hammerlock, crapped in his pants just as he touched him coming over the top.
Yeah, I bet he didn't know
where was he going.
Yeah.
You talk about that victory roll. I don't know if y'all have ever done it. That's a scary move.
Ooh.
I've seen a few of them try it, dump right on their head.
It's you're sitting up on a guy's shoulders and you go straight down. It's a scary move.
Yeah. Mm. There ain't too many people can hold me or Bobby on their shoulders, so we don't have to worry about that.
I can't get up there, so I, you know.
What about you, Bobby? What's your first memories of working in Atlanta the first time?
I guess the first time I worked auditorium was for Gunkel, and that was on a Tuesday night. And don't remember a whole lot about it. It was just another night. It was a Tuesday night in Atlanta. That's when we ran Atlanta. But I can tell you the first time I ever worked Friday night in Atlanta, I come out of that dressing room and walked across that stage, son, and I thought I had died and gone to heaven.
Bobby, that was a feeling of its own at that city auditorium, wasn't it?
Yeah, I grew up as a kid sitting in the bleachers watching the matches. I was there every Friday night, and I just, you know, there was something magical about that for me. And it was like time stood still when I went across that stage.
You couldn't believe it was happening to you, could you?
No, I couldn't. And I took my uncle with me that night because my uncle's the one took me to all those matches. And I took him and I set him on the stage. And, of course, when I come out of the dressing room, I looked at him. And it was just, right place, right time. I tell people this all the time. When you're growing up, everybody wants to be something. You want to be a New York Yankee, or you want to play for the New York Giants or the Atlanta Falcons or whatever the case may be. And not many people get to live that dream.
That's a fact.
But, buddy, when I walked across that stage and stepped off and went toward that ring, I lived my dream that night.
You know, wrestling and probably singing and making movies is the only business that you can get in and grow up and get to work with your heroes.
Yeah.
You look at football, baseball, all their careers are too short. You know, but, I mean, you look at I've worked with almost everybody I watched growing up. You know, I've been so blessed. And I know you guys got to work with so many that you watched as a fan. And it's just, it's something. You know.
Well, Tim Woods used to laugh. You know, I used to pick at him and we would laugh about it. I saw pictures for Tim Woods when I was a kid. And then I got to get in the ring with him. I never wrestled him, but as a referee. Bill Dromo, he wrestled on the first card I ever went to in my life. And we became the best of friends for a long, long, long time. You're right. I mean, I say it every year at that reunion. My heroes are my friends. And, there's not a lot of people that wanted to be a baseball player that could call Mickey Mantle or Alex Rodriguez or whoever their hero is. But, you know, I can sit here and pull my phone book out, and I can call Jerry Oates, or I can call Bo James, or I can call Charlie Smith, or, you know, I mean, I just, I'm still living the dream, fellas, and will till I die.
I think we all will, Bobby.
And, you know, those guys didn't get to ride 500 miles in a car with their heroes, picking their brains and listening to the stories and learning. You know, I used to ride with Bill Dundee, and I'm just question after question because I wanted to learn. You know, I wanted to get better. I wanted to just pick his brain. And same thing with other people, riding with Handsome Jimmy. All these guys, you know, that's where you learn. Because they could tell you, you know, I can remember when the referee would come in a spot town somewhere in Mississippi and say, hey, you're riding back to Memphis with Dundee. Well, I knew I was going to get yelled at for 150 miles. But I knew I was going to be better tomorrow for it.
That's what guys don't understand.
No.
Well,
not
this
at all.
And Jerry, I'm sure Jerry experienced this a little bit, but it was actually before his time too. But I've been told about this. But for years and years and years, there was a hierarchy as to where you rode in the car, depending on how long you had been in the business. You know, the green guy got the hump in the back seat, or you know, the new guy or the green guy, he got in the car. He didn't say nothing unless he was talked to.
Well, even when I started, and even when you started, you didn't come into that Atlanta dressing room running your mouth.
No, sir.
Or any of the other dressing rooms around here.
No, sir. I sat over in the corner waiting on somebody to tell me what to do.
I did the same thing. First of all, you don't have anything to bring to the table.
No.
You know, and now you walk in these dressing rooms, the guy's had four matches, and he knows more than you do.
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh. Or they just getting the complete idiot out of the crowd to be the referee for the town.
Oh, jeez. I like it when you ask a guy how long he's been in the business and he tells you 4 years. Then you ask him how many matches he's had, and he goes, oh, 12.
Oh, that's a fact, man.
It is. It sure is.
What?
Oh, my goodness.
We had more matches in a week than they had in 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
That's
truth.
You try to get a guy to make a town during the week now, see what happens.
I guess that's almost impossible, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't wrestle on Tuesday night. Who wrestles on Tuesday night?
You know, I sit here one night, and I was just thinking to myself here as we have these conversations. You know, on a normal week, I refereed, on average, 5 matches a night and 6 nights a week, plus 3 TVs, Bacon TV, Atlanta TV 2 hours, and Columbus TV. You know, I mean, it wasn't unusual for me to referee 50, 60 matches a week.
See, that's unheard of,
yeah.
Man. Bob.
And you do that for you know, and we closed, what, 3-4 days at Christmas, and that was it?
Yep.
And I mean,
you
know,
but see, you didn't think nothing about it.
No, it was just, that was life.
That was your job.
Yeah.
I know. Talking about riding in the car, who was your favorite person to travel with?
Mine was Johnny Eagles. Funniest. I know we come out of Spokane, Washington one night going back to Portland. He started telling jokes. I mean, that was a long trip. He started telling jokes and never told the same one again. I mean, it was me and Ricky Hunter and him and Ed Wiskowski. We laughed and laughed. And he was with that accent of his, he was a great guy to travel with. Because now you're talking about somebody that's been all over the world. He had. I know when we were in Oregon, his daughter's teacher, she sent a note home, said, you need to come see, you know, we need to talk about Nikki. They was having some kind of history class, I mean, a world geography or something. And every time they would mention, like, South Africa, France, Germany, Spain, this place, she'd raise her hand. And she said, I've been there. So the teacher thinks she's, you know, out in left field. So Johnny goes up to the school and wonders what the problem was. And she said, well, we've got a problem. She says, you know, no matter where we mention, she says she's been there. Johnny says she has. The teacher about crawled under her desk. It's just, you know, I wish I'd have gotten in a little earlier and went to some of these places these guys went to. Bobby, they you know, you could go all over the world.
Yeah, you could wrestle all over the world back then.
Yeah, Belgium, you know, just wherever.
Yes, some of these countries now, you couldn't pay somebody, especially an American, enough to go into them.
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's, oh, you need to be held hostage somewhere. We just want to work.
Yeah.
We didn't come over here for no politics. We just want to work. Who's your favorite traveling partner, Bobby?
I guess I had two. I guess John Walker was one of them. And, three, John Walker, Ronnie West, and Rocket Monroe.
Well, I know where you like riding with Johnny Walker, because you knew you was going to be home in record time.
Yeah. You have to, yeah. No grass grew under the car.
The only time he ever scared me,
though, was when he bought that rabbit, that little Volkswagen.
He drove it just the same way as he did that.
Big 88. Yeah. The last trip I guess I made with him was to Chattanooga, Tennessee, or one of the last ones, and we rode in that rabbit. And son, he scared me so bad I closed my eyes. I wasn't asleep, but I was not going to watch because I think that rabbit was only hitting the ground at the high spots.
Whew.
Oh man!
He drove a car, man.
Who was worse, him or Garvin?
Garvin was the worst.
Garvin was crazy.
I experienced that one time, and I made a deal with my maker. If you get me out of this car, I'm done. That's the scariest I've ever been in an automobile, besides him and Harley.
I rode with Garvin from Beckley, West Virginia, to St. Albans, West Virginia, up at twisting Interstate 77. And he just made a straight line. He never followed the curves. He just followed a straight line about 100 miles an hour. And I told him, I said, if you get me there, I'm not riding back with you. I'll walk if it comes down to that. I'm not getting back in this car.
Was that the scariest you ever been in a car?
Oh, yeah. Oh, terrified.
It was me.
Yeah.
And
he's just sitting over there like it's Sunday drive.
He gets over out there in that left-hand lane. He starts blinking those lights. He'll get on their bumper.
Yeah.
You ever ride with anybody?
No.
Whew.
I've had him pass me 100 miles an hour in the emergency lane. There wouldn't be nothing in the left lane. I'd be in the right lane, and I'd see these headlights behind me coming at 100 miles an hour, and it would come right up behind me and then just duck off in the emergency lane and go by me.
Yeah, that was one time for me, brother.
He asked me if I wanted to ride in the plane with him one time. He had a little four-seater plane somewhere. And I said, no, I was in the car with you once. That was enough. There ain't no way I'm getting in a plane.
Yeah. At least if you're on the ground and you jump out, you got a small chance of surviving. But from, 15,000 feet, it ain't going to happen.
Bobby, we wrestled on Macon TV. You might, and we went to Albany that night, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who flew down with him. They was white as sheets when they got there. They said he was flying under bridges, buzzing cow fields.
He was flying into Charlotte from somewhere in a little plane. He had Jimmy Valiant, Ricky Morton, and Robert Gibson with him, and they got hit by lightning. The plane got hit by lightning in the air, so everything on his dash went dead. He dropped down and read the road signs on the interstate and followed them to the airport.
I believe that. No, yeah. I can believe it. He must be one heck of a pilot, but I'll take their word for it.
The funniest story I've heard about him flying was after he got out of the business and he was flying that commercial jet or plane for whoever it was. Well, he buzzed Mac's house. He buzzed Mac McMurray's house up on that mountain. He said he got so low that it shook the house.
Yeah, he killed two trees in Mac's yard.
Yeah. I mean, he was. But the funniest thing he did was he told me that he told this himself. He had some guy with him that didn't know him, and he was doing his crazy stuff. And they were buzzing boats on some river. And he said he went down and he could cut all the lights on the plane off. And he'd go down behind him and he'd buzz these boats. Well, he said he went down and he buzzed this boat. And he said when he buzzed it, all the lights on the boat come on. And it was a Coast Guard boat.
Yeah.
He said he was just fortunate that he got high enough, quick enough, that they did not get the number off the plane.
They could have shot him out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Who was your least favorite to travel with?
Well, I can answer that because I only made one trip with him, and that was Billy Spears. He not only run up behind people in that left lane, he would bump their bumper if they wouldn't move. And he got to herbally medicating himself, and I thought, Lord, if I'm going to jail, I ain't going to jail for somebody else's stupidity. Just let me get to the town.
I'm trying to think. Garvin would have to be for me. I wouldn't ride to the 7-Eleven with him.
Oh, have you ever left anybody alongside the road?
I've never left anybody on alongside the road, but I left the guy one time. I was going to Knoxville. And Dale Veazey lived in Albany, Georgia, and I told him to be there at 2:30. Because, see, I'm not going to be, that's one thing I said, I was never late anywhere I was ever booked, ever. I was always early. And I wasn't going to be late on account of him or anybody else. So I said, 2:30. So I gave him 5 minutes. At 2:35, I left Oaks Gym by myself and drove to Knoxville. He got in there, he come in there about 45 minutes later, mad as a wet hen. Man, I can't believe this. I come from Albany to Columbus and you'd already gone. I said, what time did I tell you to be there? He said, you said 2:30. He said, I got held up by a train. I said, I didn't know that. I said, and I left you. I wasn't going, left anybody on the road. No, I've never done that. I wouldn't have done that.
So nobody climbed trees while they was riding with you then?
They what?
I said, nobody climbed the tree.
Oh, no, sir. Now, I would have left him. I'll tell you. I don't care who his daddy was. I don't know if Bobby had any tree climbers or what.
No. I had a couple of guys that we missed connections because of them being late. I left Ray Candy one time because he was late, but I never put nobody out on the side of the road.
No, I wouldn't do that.
I'll just keep my mouth shut about that, dear. I've left a few. So who's your favorite person to work with?
That's a powerful question there. I tell you who I really love working with, and that was Harley. I love working with him.
Is he just a machine? I mean, it's unbelievable how many hour Broadways he could do in a week.
Yeah, he had his own speed, and that was okay with me. You know, I work with guys. If you want to pick it up, I'll be right there with you. But he had his style, and it suited me to a T. You know, I didn't care. You know, it didn't matter what guys. I was kind of prided myself in. I could work with anybody, and of course, if you couldn't work with Harley Race, you didn't need to be there anyhow. But he had his own style, and I loved his style. He was slow and methodical. And I did. Of course, there's a lot of other guys I really enjoy. I mean, you couldn't wait to get in the ring with him. But he would be my probably number one choice.
What about yours, Bobby?
From a refereeing standpoint, anybody. My favorite match that I ever was involved in refereeing was the best match I guess I ever refereed was Jack Briscoe and Dore Funk Jr.
You had the best seat in the house.
I probably refereed 10, 15 of those. And,
well, I'm going to tell you something about Bobby Simmons, and not because Bobby's on the air. There was a lot of referees that were good referees, you know. That Bobby was probably one of the top five, maybe number one. I don't know. He was. You didn't even know Bobby was there, and that's the way it's supposed to be. But when you needed him, he was there. If that makes any sense.
I appreciate that.
And I always thought he was he's always professional. He never clowned. He never cut up. He was always doing his job.
I appreciate that very much.
Well, that's a true compliment. I mean,
I guess hardest thing in the world to learn as a referee was something Tom Ernesto told me the very first day. He said, referee's not part of the show. And, man, you're just getting into business and you think, what do you mean I'm not part of the show, man? I want to be part of the show. But, my job was to referee. And hard thing to learn how to do, stay out of the way. And
but you was one of the best at that, Bobby.
That's I appreciate that. I tried. I you know, God knows I didn't want to. I didn't want nobody to get hurt because I was in the way, and it happened. Poor old Gene Anderson. One time, I got in the way of him, and he run face first into a turnbuckle, and he told me, he said, he was as nice as he could be. He said, and I was working in Charlotte at Greenville, South Carolina. He said, man, he said, what are you doing there? And I said, I was in the corner. I was trying to be out of the way. You didn't tell me you was going to take a U-turn and come at me. But, yeah, it was a. I've seen guys get hurt because referees in the way. Yep. And they have to alter what they're doing, and that's just so unnecessary.
Did you work for Blackwell at all, Bobby? Were you done by
then? No, I'd quit by then.
Blackwell was running. We was running up in L.J. George, and this referee, he little smart mass kid. I don't know how many matches he might have refereed. Well, I got out in the ring, and he was more involved with my partner than I was. Well, it didn't take me about 2 minutes. I almost beat that boy to death, and he didn't even know it, that I was doing it on purpose. He got kicked. He got run over. He got elbowed. I know he. I bet he went back and said, "Man, Sherry, you're the most clumsiest joker I've been around." About beating him to death, man. He still didn't get it, and I never told him any different.
Well, you know, there was some
guys.
He
wouldn't have got it even if you told him. He wouldn't have got it.
You know, there was a couple of guys. There was two or three guys that I got beat to death with that I was, you know, that I wasn't in the way. You just couldn't help it.
I mean, they were great. I know that's right.
Great wrestlers, but they were Tim Woods, great example.
Yeah.
Smooth as glass in most aspects, but he was clumsy. Baron Von Raschke, Jim Raschke, clumsy. Ox Baker, you could be his tag team partner and get beat to death.
Well, that brings me to the next question. Who is your least favorite person to work with?
Moose Cholock.
I knew that was going to be. I told Misty 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, "Jay Decker is going to be Moose Cholock."
Well, it was a toss-up: Moose Cholock and the McGuire twin.
You didn't have to bring that up. But see, that's a Bo James question right there. He already knew the answer, without a doubt.
What about yours, Bobby?
Argentina Apollo.
Really?
I never did see much of him.
He would middle a referee in a heartbeat. He thought he was being funny. He would do things like the heel would have him down in the corner, would have his foot on his throat choking him. And you'd go over there and you'd work with the heel, and then finally you'd start counting. Well, you'd get to four and the heel's not backing up, and you'd look down and he'd be holding the heel's foot
yeah.
or the heel couldn't move. And he did all sorts of stuff like that. And he thought it was funny.
Yeah, no, that marries the referee right there.
Well, until Ernesto told me to disqualify the guy a couple of times when we ended that. But, you know, I mean, he would look at you like, you did what? But, yeah, he was the only one that ever did that to me.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. I mean, nice guy. I never had no problem with him. He thought he was being funny.
And they just don't understand. Marrying the referee, the referee's got to have credibility.
Thank you.
I mean, he's the law and order in the ring. He's the policeman. I mean, I see that every weekend somewhere. I see referees, the wrestlers either bury them or they bury themselves, and you try to help them and go, say, let me tell you something, and then they get all hot and just walk off. We had one in Creston, North Carolina, Misty's match. She takes headlock takeover. Person Misty's working with on the side, the guy counts 1, 2, 3. He said, well, he was down.
So
they tried to tell him, and he don't get it. And then before I go to the ring, he come and asked me, he said, are you going to be cheating? I need to know if you're going to be cheating. I said, the best thing you can do is walk right over there and buy a ticket. That's my best advice I can give you.
Yeah, that's why I said, you need to give me this shirt right now, pal.
Yeah.
A lot of love has been in the ring with him.
You know, the thing is, you know, again, you know, Ernesto told me, he said, you're not part of the show. And that's a hard thing to, I mean, you know, as a kid, that's a hard thing to understand. I mean, I learned very quickly, but I was blessed to have people like Ernesto and Jody Hamilton and Dickie Steinborn teaching me and telling me, you know, you don't do this, you don't do that way, you do it this way. And I was, call me naive or stupid, but I was glad they was telling me that stuff because it was helping me.
Yeah, that's a cold-blooded thing to say. You're not a part of the show, but you're one of the biggest parts.
Yeah, I understand, but you know, have to. What he said was, you're not part of the show unless I say you're part of the show.
Right.
And what he was trying to tell me was, you're the referee.
Right.
You know, you be the referee. You call what you, if you see the guy pull hair, break it up. If you don't see it, you can't break it up. And part of the art of refereeing is learning. And Wayne Cowan, first match, gave me a great piece of advice. He said, Bobby, work to the left of the heel. Okay. I'd never heard that before. So I started positioning myself to the left of the heel. That way he could take his right hand and do whatever he wanted to do, and I couldn't see it.
Right.
And yeah. You know, just little tricks like that. But these guys today... Charlie Smith told a story at our reunion this year. He went to work a show to sell his gimmicks. They took a guy off the front row and put a referee shirt on him.
You know what?
And Charlie said the guy jumped in the ring and was up on the apron throwing his hands up in the air like he was some kind of star.
I see it. I see that 4 or 5 times a year somewhere. I see people do that. And they go, it don't matter. It's just a referee. That's your excuse.
Jeez.
No.
Well, I'm glad I come from a different era because I wouldn't be able to witness to that. I couldn't take that. I had more pride in what I did than I don't know.
Well, that's the thing that's missing right here. It's 99.999% of what's out there now. It's a hobby. It's fun and games. It's playtime.
Right. They don't care if they draw or not.
They don't care if they make a dime. You know. I mean, it's. I go back to that old saying, nothing's for fun.
I had one tell me one time, I asked him, I said, how much money are you making? He said, I don't do this to make money. He said, I just want to be in the wrestling business. And I said, you've lost your mind.
And that shows you how easy it is to get in the wrestling business now.
Jeez.
Well, they're not in the wrestling business, they're in the hobby business.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. All right, before we start burying everybody, let's go to the next question. Favorite building?
City Auditorium in Atlanta for me.
Yeah, that'd be mine too. Yeah, without a doubt.
I mean, we had some good ones around here. Bell Auditorium in Augusta was good.
It just had that atmosphere to it.
Yeah. Jerry can tell you more about this than me. I never worked there, but they say that sports arena in Savannah was great.
It was very good. It had the atmosphere.
Yeah. Auditorium in Columbus was good, but the Auditorium in Columbus was, I mean, that building was so long. It was built funny. It was so long that it was, I mean, I've seen it sold out, but I don't know. To me, it just didn't have the atmosphere that Bell in Atlanta did.
Now the bell's right there at the top.
Yeah.
No matter where you sat there, it was unbelievable.
That was a great building.
That building actually was like it was built for wrestling. Yeah, I'm with Bobby, the Auditorium, Atlanta.
What was the worst building you ever worked in?
Somewhere it was in, I'll tell you where it was, in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. I'm telling you what I know now. Well, you left. You want to. It was.
This is an everlasting memory because that come quick. You didn't even have to think a second about that.
I've been there, too. It was some kind of auction house or something, wasn't it?
I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Oh, I think Mississippi's the first. Anytime anybody's asked where's the worst building they ever worked in, I believe Mississippi's always the first one that comes out.
It was for me, and I've been in some doozies. I even been to Quincy, Florida. You ever go there, Bobby?
Yes, sir.
It could compare to the one in Hattiesburg.
You know, a lot of the buildings in Alabama were farm centers, so you dealt with dirt floors.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of those down there. You know, now I'm not knocking that territory. There was a lot of money made in that Gulf Coast territory. You worked at a roller skating rink in Panama City.
I've been in that building.
Was the Rainbow Roller Rink, I think, was
that's
the name
exactly
of it.
That's exactly what it was.
Golly. I'm trying to think of some of them other places. That Quonset hut in Murphy, North Carolina, was interesting. I booked a town one time in Georgia. Charlie Smith always laughs at me, and Alan Jackson wrote a song about Pavo, Georgia. It's a little town.
Hey,
it's just a little dot on the map down in South Georgia.
I have 10 people in Pavo.
Ran a building at the end of the airport runway there, a little single runway, small plane airport. I booked the building down there with a JC's as my sponsor, and I went down there and drew $5,000. They come out of the woods, and this is when ticket prices was $3. And the
that's
second,
strong
and I, house, it was so good, it was so good. And you know, I was doing it for the office; I wasn't making no money. And the second time I ran it, Ric Flair had just won the title. He won it the night before, and he came in to fulfill Dusty or Harley, whoever he got it from that time. He came in here to fulfill his bookings. And the first night in the territory, they booked him in Pavo, Georgia.
They did not.
Yes, sir. He was in Pavo, Georgia. And I think the second time we ran it, we did like $3,500, $4,000. But we did it. We drew a lot of money in that little old stupid building. And I don't know where the people came from. Because, I mean,
well, Moultrie wasn't far, and, you know, they come from. I don't think that many people was in Pavo.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't either. Did you ever work in Norman Park, Georgia? Little town right outside of Moultrie there. Leon used to run that for Mr. Ward every once in a while.
What's it called?
Norman Park, Georgia.
No, sir. No.
Worked that one a few times.
Did it draw?
It did all right. And I'll tell you another one, too, Bo. This is something that not a lot of people have done, and I know Jerry's done this. The state of Georgia, and it wasn't the worst building now, but just talking about bad places to work, the state of Georgia used to pay Mr. Ward to put wrestling on at the Georgia State Mental Institution in Milledgeville, Georgia.
I did a couple of shows here at Green Valley Hospital, that's what it's called now. I did a couple here.
It was a state mental institution. They had the Women's State Correctional Facility, Hardwick, is on the same grounds as the mental hospital, or it was back then. And you'd go in, and the building was like any high school gym you'd ever been in. And all the patients at the hospital were in different dormitories around the facility, and they would put each one in a different section of the bleachers on the side. And then on the stage on the far end, they'd bring all them women prisoners out of Hardwick up there and put them on the stage. There'd be a guard at either end of that stage with a shotgun. And then on the other end of the building, there was a little balcony, and that's where they put the people where there really wasn't nobody. You know, the lights was on, but they had moved out.
Please tell me they looked crazy Luke Graham in there.
Oh, we all made
that
shot.
But you know, the townspeople could come, too. You know,
they bought tickets and sat at ringside. Sure did.
There's something else, wasn't it?
It was interesting, man.
It's really pitiful, though.
The very first time I ever went to that town, one of those patients come down out of that balcony and hit the rail and never stopped, went right over the rail and hit the floor, dead as 4 o'clock.
Whew.
All the heels were trying to take credit as to who he was trying to get to. I mean, it was really sad.
There was something else.
Did you ever meet the little lady that used to watch the door to the babyface dressing room? They called her the Gripper.
Yeah, was she the one that brought the food?
Well, somebody, I don't remember. Yeah, there was always cakes and pies, and, you know, I wouldn't eat
none
of it, but there was always stuff in there.
Who made that food?
Jerry Briscoe took me outside and said, "I want you to meet the Gripper." And her and Danny Hodge would have had a good contest.
Oh, come on.
She grabbed my hand, son, and made me cry. I mean, she just poured it on me, and I was like, "Yes, ma'am, that's nice."
Oh, Which brings me to the next question. What's the best rib you ever had pulled on you?
If you got one, Bobby, go. I got mine.
It really wasn't played on me, but I just happened to be involved in it. Was the day the guy showed up saying he wanted to wrestle at the office, and Doug Smith hit him with a baseball bat. That, I guess, Charlie Smith set that whole thing in motion, but we didn't know it till a week later. I mean, you know, I had all the normal stuff like Dromo tying my clothes in knots and throwing my clothes to me when I was standing in the shower. And
oh, that was just every night thing.
You know, that was kind of normal stuff. I don't know. It really, the only thing I can think of that really ever got me was the guy coming to the office. That really wasn't a rib. That just was something that happened that I happened to get caught in the middle of.
Well, then we, looking back now, you can laugh about it.
Well, the funny thing about that whole story, and I know I've told it before, I won't go through the whole thing, but the funny part of that whole story was Barnett in that back office back there, and there was a door back there that I had tried to get open and could not get open because it had swollen shut where the weather had got it got wet, and the frame and the door and everything. I mean, you could not open that door. I bumped it. I pushed on it, kicked it, could not get it open. And I'm standing in the lobby with a pistol in my hand, and I look up, and here comes Barnett. He got that door open. Got that door open. He walked out there to me, and he goes, "Mr. Bobby, you have a gun. I'm going to stay with you till the police arrive." And I went, "Okay."
What's yours, Jerry?
Well, I don't know how the word got around, but me and Armstrong were scared of snakes, right? I mean, horrified. So we had done making TV, and we went to America's Georgia that night. So Bobby knows those dressing rooms. You know, you could walk by and just swing the door open, see where everybody's sitting.
Yeah.
Theirs was across the hall. So, and you could go to the bathroom right by our dressing room, and Spears and Colt come by there and kick the dressing room door open to see where Armstrong and I were sitting. And our bags were right beside each other, so we didn't think nothing about it. We thought they were just clowning. So about a minute later, that door flew open. Something black was thrown in that dressing room. It looked like it was about 5 feet long. And it landed in my bag, Bob's bag. And we both looked at the same time and said, "This is a real snake." Well, we hit that door at the same time. And we went running out that, you remember that back door used to be open by that big
yeah.
door? We were getting it. And of course, Armstrong was way ahead of me. Somebody, one of the boys was pulling up, said, "Where's Armstrong going?" He was wide open, getting it. He must have run up another block before he come back. But I mean, you tell me, it like scared us to death. So I didn't sit by Armstrong anymore, and he didn't sit by me. But I didn't have too many fools on me. I really didn't.
So are you still afraid of snakes?
Horrified.
You got to have them around Savannah and out there on that island then.
So they got rattlesnakes. I said, "You can ride."
That's when your pager don't go off, right? When you hear that snake call.
My radio, I said, "I didn't have any signal out where I was."
Francisco Flores was in here working as the Avenger, and somebody was talking about this the other day. I think Joe Turner was talking about it when we were down in Mobile. He had Francisco Flores real scared of snakes same way. I mean, he would just panic, and they threw a snake on him or threw one at him one night somewhere, and they went in the ring to work. He was working with Jody Hamilton, and they went in the ring, and every time Jody would get him in a headlock, he'd lean down and go, "Amigo, I got that snake head in my trunks." And he'd run his hand in his trunks. And they said Flores would back out of that headlock and jump the top rope and hit the floor. There would be no. He was like, he said, if you'd been an Olympic scorer, you'd have given him a 10 for altitude and landing.
If you're scared of them, I'm telling you.
Oh, I don't like them either. Oof.
We got copperheads all around us here where we live up here in the woods. Every spring I got to kill them in my yard. If you don't, they'll be in the house.
Well, I won't stay with you.
I heard that.
Yeah, I get most of them. I might find one late summer. It's down here in the backyard somewhere, but then they're big. You know.
If I lived up there, something like OK Corral, I'd be.
All right. I had several people send in the questions for you guys. I'm going to try to get to all of them. The first one is Chris from St. Louis. And, Jerry, he wants your fondest memories of working in St. Louis, and he wants to know why Marty Jannetty was Marty Oates in St. Louis.
That's when we were working for Manizak. And Manizak wanted me to bring Ted, and I forgot where Ted was, what Ted was doing at the time. I said, Ted's not going to be able to make it. I said, but I can bring a kid that I trained named Marty Jannetty. I said, I can bring him out there as Marty Oates as our kid brother. He said, that'd be fine. And, you know, to this day, people still think he's an Oates. That's how that got started.
Yeah.
Probably one of my fondest memories out there was working, working with Murdoch on a double main event there in St. Louis, and Bruno was on the other main event. But I enjoyed working in St. Louis. St. Louis was a good pay town. And of all the time, I mean, they protected that town. That town was nothing. It was unbelievable. You could go out there and hook up and snatch a headlock, and the people would just, like, ooh. I mean, they love wrestling.
Telling Bobby today, I had never seen it till Larry Mazanek put together those DVDs, the best of St. Louis that he's got out now. And, man, the people, even at the TVs, they're as hot in the TVs as they were in any town.
The sad part about it, was the worst ring in the United States.
That's what I was getting ready to ask you. Why was that ring so big and was it as hard as it looked?
It was so hard that when guys would come there the first time, like if you just go suplex somebody or give them a belly to back, they'd always try to get you to. They'd tell you, man, don't belly to back or suplex somebody right in the center of that ring. It was an old boxer's boxing ring, and it was so hard. I mean, you know, you try to get off to the side out of the center to do it. But it was hard. The money they made out of that town had a ring like that. I never understood.
Yeah,
I never understood it.
I've got one of the two ring battle royals they did in the Keel, and they got the TV ring, which was huge, and then beside it, that ring, it looks like it's double the size of the TV ring. I mean, they look like football fields instead of rings.
That TV ring was just as hard.
Did you ever work TV when they did it at that hotel?
No, Bobby, I did not know. We were still at the Chase. We were at the Chase. But not where they had the tables and all.
Oh, okay.
No, but we did TV at the Chase, yeah.
So
there was a wrestling town, man. That was a great wrestling town.
They run the Keel, and then the next day they would do the TVs for the month going into the next Keel. Is that how they did that?
That's not how they did it. We wrestled in St. Louis on Friday, and then you would come back on Sunday and do the TV.
Okay.
I mean, we'd go back to Kansas City and have to go back to St. Louis.
TVs were done
on a Sunday. But that was a wrestling town. I mean, my gosh, they protected that town. That town was just, oh my gosh. It was unbelievable.
How far was it from Kansas City to St. Louis?
250.
250.
Nothing but cornfields on both sides of you.
That's it.
My sister, her first husband, was a guard at Leavenworth. He's in the service. We went out there, and I'd read about Central States and St. Louis and the magazines, everything when I was a kid, and we went out there, and we crossed across Missouri, and I thought, well, there's no towns for them to even wrestle in here. it was nothing. And then you get to Kansas City, it just pops up out of nowhere, and it's huge, and then 10 minutes you're out of it, you're back out in the cornfields.
That's right. Well, you should go out to Kansas.
Now, I've been all the way out to Topeka. and all the way across the, from there all the way to Colby, Kansas. They had to be some long, miserable trips out there in the wintertime.
You've got no idea. You've got no idea. Go from Kansas City to, hey, I didn't make this trip. Ted made it a couple times. Hayes, Kansas. That's right there on the Colorado border.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in between there, brother. That's a sparse state, I'm telling you. We wrestle in, we actually wrestle in Kansas City, Kansas, not Kansas City, Missouri. They cross the river from each other. That's where we wrestle.
Yeah, Memorial Hall.
Yeah, and then we wrestle in Wichita and Topeka. Those, other than that, there was no big towns. That was it, three towns. That was it. Well, Hutchinson, Kansas, and Hayes, Kansas. I wrestled on the last card guy got ever promoted in Dodge City. I think everybody there was on Boot Hill. Or in Boot Hill, not on Boot Hill.
Yeah.
Oh, God, it was horrible. That's way out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Go ahead. Rich Patterson, he is the Portland wrestling historian. He does as much as he can to keep the history alive, and he's also the radio producer for the Portland Trailblazers.
Really?
And he great guy. And he wants to know, why was your stay in the Northwest so short? And why did you never come back?
Well, I'll tell you how I wound up there. I was wrestling Harley in New Orleans. That's when he was a champion. We're in the middle of the ring. He told me, we're getting instructions. He said, Don Owens wants you in Portland, Oregon. I'm like, what? Just wrestling for the title, and you telling me Don Owens wants me in Portland? So I got with him the next day, and we called Don Owens. I don't know how Don Owens knew who I was. Anyhow, I called him, yeah, blah, 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 blah. He gave me the starting date. So I left Louisiana, went home, back to Columbus, sold my vehicle. Kathy and I had sent some household goods ahead, and Jesse Ventura and his wife picked them up for us, and then we got on a plane one night and flew all the way to Oregon and got out of there, and I loved it. I loved it. I had a great time. It was a great crew, great trips. Money was great. It wasn't the most gigantic territory, but, you know, you had Don Owens was a great payoff man. I mean, I was making money hand over fist and enjoyed everybody.
Small crew there, too, right? They always had a small crew, too, didn't they? The middle 18 guys was most they ever had in there.
Well, Don didn't load the card up where, you know, he'd fix it where everybody could make money and had some good towns. Talent was good. I enjoyed working for him. He was a great man. So I'm out there, and Ted's in Charlotte. I was in Portland 6 months, and Ted called me one night, and he said, George Scott's got a starting date for you if you want it. I'm thinking, and that's when Charlotte was on fire. I mean, oh, my God. So, you know, my gosh, only been here 6 months. So anyhow, I left, and I made more money than I ever made in a territory in Charlotte when I got there. But anyhow, I never went back. I mean, that's a long way to go, but I enjoyed it. I loved it. And as a matter of fact, my wife said one night last week, she said, you know, she said, I could have lived in Portland.
My wife said, we've been out there 3 times. Misty said the same thing. We love it out there, but, man, it's expensive to live in Portland or Seattle.
And let me tell you, that Seattle is one of the most gorgeous places at night you've ever seen. It's just up there on that hill, and, I mean, it's just, oh, my gosh.
Especially if you're out there on that island right across the sound from it looking at it, it's pretty cool.
Oh, now, really, I had heard this before I got there. You know, it rains every day. I mean, nowhere rained every day for 9 months. 24 hours a day, it drizzles. It's like they got a sprinkler system, but it's not rain hard, it just drizzles.
When I was there, it rained about 4 o'clock every day, a storm would come through, and it would rain about 4 o'clock every afternoon when I was out
when
there.
When were you there?
I was out there 2004, 2005, 2006. Went back
what time of the year?
Twice in the winter, once in the summer.
in the winters every day.
Yeah.
In Portland. But they said, wait till it clears up. And they were right. When it cleared up, it was gorgeous. No humidity, no nothing, man.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I could have lived out there.
I liked the Dalles. That was a cool town there with the rivers coming through there. I liked that.
Yeah, I would have liked to have stayed longer. I should have probably. I really should have and not gone to Charlotte. But I enjoyed it. I mean, it was a great crew. You know, Snooker was there. Jesse was there. Waskowski was there. Buddy Rose was there. And everybody got a chance, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't like you was on a slot. Everybody got their turn, you know. It was a unique place. It was one of the most different promotions I'd ever worked for.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It was laid back, no pressure on you, you know. Just go out and do your job. Don was happy. And he would pay you too, buddy.
Yeah. What, would you work 6 days a week there or seven?
Seven.
Yeah.
But I didn't care about that. I mean, I was home.
Yeah.
I hardly ever spend a night anywhere.
Bobby, I got a question from my pastor, Donnie, who grew up in Savannah, and he wants to know, how did Reverend Stokes become the promoter of Savannah?
When the split first happened, Mr. Newman, who was Jerry's father-in-law, came with Ann. And he stayed, I don't know, he wasn't long. And they, whatever the deal was, Jerry probably knows better than me, they lured him back to the NWA office. And we had to have a promoter in Savannah. And I'm not real sure what the connection was or how it came to be, but I guess they were looking for someone with a little clout in the community or whatever, and I guess Stokes just happened to fit the bill.
Tom lined that up.
Do what?
Tom lined that up.
I'm sure Tom was. Yeah, I should say I'm sure.
And Stokes were tight.
That was a Stokes was a piece of work.
He was a piece of work. You know, he just died here recently.
Did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, maybe, Bobby, something like that.
I didn't know. Me and him were not the best of friends. He promoted. He would run some spot shows around here and there. I remember they sent the ring one night. He ran a National Guard armory over in South Carolina. I can't remember what.
Y'all didn't know anything about it.
Do what?
Y'all didn't know anything about it.
Yeah. It was for Ann. And
they sent
me with a ring. And when I got over there and I got to the building, he told me he was standing outside, and I pulled up, and he goes, there's a roll-up door on the end of the armory. You can roll the door up, and you can put the ring in through the back of the truck in. And I went, oh, okay, thank you. So I go around there. Well, when they roll the door open, much to my shock, all the chairs were set up sort of in a semicircle, but in a theater-type setting. He wanted me to set that ring just inside that door and set it up, and all the chairs would have been on three sides, sort of like a theater, going back on a flat floor in a National Guard armory, and the one side of the ring would have been up against that door.
Oh, come on, man.
Oh, yeah. And I asked him, I said, what are we doing here? And he goes, oh, I went ahead and set the chairs up. I said, not like this, you're not. And I had to move the chairs and put the ring up and reset all the chairs. I mean, he had no clue. He was, you know, and you couldn't tell him anything. He always had, whenever he would show up in a town, he would always have two or three large women with him, and I'm being kind. And they were all, it was never the same ones, and they were all members, quote unquote, of his church. And, yeah, he was a real piece of work.
Who checked up?
He did.
All right.
You know, I'll leave it at that.
That's the reason I asked, sir.
Yeah,
he was,
I had nothing. When he run the towns, I had nothing to do with that. I didn't take anything back to the office. That was all handled through him. And none of the towns ever drew. You know, he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know how to do it. And I went to Waycross one time and got to the building about 4 o'clock, and couldn't get in, couldn't find any posters. I looked all over town, couldn't find any posters, you know. So I called the office, and I said, hey, I said, I can't get in the building. I don't see anybody. I can't find any posters. I said, is everything still okay? And Tom Harbin answered the phone. He put me on the phone with Tom, and Tom goes, yeah, just stay at the building. Somebody will be there. Well, next thing I know, Stokes drives up about 5:30. Boy, and he gets out, and he proceeds. He's going to jump on me for calling the office. And
he did not.
Let's just say that didn't last long, and we really weren't friends after that. So, but just, yeah, I don't know. I heard he got kicked out of his church for being caught for fraternizing with some of his members. Now, I don't know if that's true or not.
I think that's what happened. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I'd heard that. Well, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but truth will be here when everything else is gone. You know, he went in Charlie Smith's pocket one night. Charlie was in a ring refereeing. He went in Charlie's pants pocket and got his car keys out and gave them to his son and told his son to drive Bill Eady and his partner there, what's his name, Lewis, whatever, the Mongols.
Yeah, I know you're talking about.
You know, talking about, he gave his son the keys, told him to take Charlie's car and drive him to the airport.
He did not.
Oh, yeah. Now, I cannot repeat on the radio or any other place what Charlie called him and said to him, but the gist of it was, I'm like the Lone Ranger, and I have a silver bullet in this gun, as he was waving it at him with your name on it. If you ever go in my pockets, I'm not running a taxi cab. I mean, it was, oh, and you know, looking around, we were outnumbered.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it was kind of the only time I ever saw Savannah sold out in that building. The whole, out of all the years I went there, was when Candy got married in the ring. That was the only time.
Yeah.
Here's another one from Donnie. He grew up in Savannah. He first started watching wrestling when the Oaks brothers were working with Savage and Poffo. He said that's what made him a fan. He said, but when he thinks of Jerry Oates, he remembers Pac's song with the chops to your knee.
Yep, that was the beginning of something. But I never worked. Ted worked with Savage and Lanny. That's when they were with Ann.
With Ann, yeah.
Yeah, we did that deal with Pac Song, and had my first knee surgery after that, and went on from there. And he was a big man. He was big. But he was a pleasure to work with.
Oh, yeah,
a guy his size, really was.
Very very easy to work. His head, yep. His head was 2 feet tall, wasn't it?
The what, Bobby?
His head was 2 feet tall. He looked like a bobblehead.
Yeah, he had acromegaly. Yeah,
he was huge.
Was that the giant, like Andre had the giant disease?
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah, I always wondered that with the pictures and videos I've seen of him, if he had that.
Yeah, Baba had it. Japan, he had it. Did you ever go to Japan, Bo?
No, never have.
Hey, you missed something there.
Yeah, I tell everybody I'm 30 years, so it's 30 years too late.
That's about right.
I got to work in Tennessee, and, you know, I started when I was 14 for Ron West, selling programs and putting the ring up and everything else. Started reffing when I was 15. And I missed everything by a decade.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah. So, all right, I got some names here. I'm going to say a name. I want you to just tell me the first thing that pops in your head. So I got a few individual and a few for both of you. So let's start with both. Dusty Rhodes.
One of the greatest mouthpieces that ever was in the business.
Yeah. He could talk.
He could roll around in the mud too, couldn't he, Bob?
Yeah, he could roll in the mud too. That was a good devil guy. I'll tell you something else, man. I won $20. Here's a guy that played college football, and I won a $20 belt off of him over a rule question. We had a discussion one night in the Omni about whether or not you could fair catch a kickoff. And I said, yes, you can. And he said, no, you can't. I said, yes, you can. And I went out and bought a rule book and showed it to him, and he paid up.
All right, Ox Baker.
If you didn't stab his way, he'd kill you.
Hit me harder than any human being has ever hit me.
Bobby said it earlier, most awkward, clumsiest man. That's about all I can say.
Now, I'll tell you something else about Ox, and I don't know if he still does it or not. He used to paint his toenails.
I've heard that.
And they were all different colors. And the reason he did it, he told me one time, he said he promised his wife, as long as he loved her, he would paint his toenails and not be ashamed of it. And I've seen him sit in the dressing room and paint his toenails.
Well,
maybe he's got lead poisoning or something, I don't know.
What about Andre the Giant?
Andre the Giant. You asked me the first thing that pops in my head for him. I felt sorry for him. He was a miserable man. That size, his size was, you know, he made the best of it because that's all he knew, but he was miserable.
He never seemed happy, did he?
No, it never did, Bobby.
No,
never did.
He was a joy to work with. I mean, he was.
He
was light as a feather in the ring. But he just. I mean, he was. I wouldn't have wanted him to get mad at me.
But everything for him was uncomfortable. You know,
yeah.
No matter what. No, I mean, it was just an effort. I mean, I can't imagine being that big.
Riding in a car was a chore for him.
I took him from Columbus to Griffin one night. And I had a Toyota.
Oh, God.
He needed a ride. I said, big man. I said, I'm in a Toyota. That's okay, boss. That's okay. You should have seen that sight.
All right. Well, Wahoo McDaniel.
Wahoo McDaniel. Wahoo. Wahoo was Wahoo. I love Wahoo. Wahoo was fun to be around. Very hard worker. I can't say anything but great things about Wahoo.
Yeah.
I love being around him. I never, thank God, I never got chopped by him.
I did.
Yeah, I'm thankful for you too.
I'll never forget, we was in Charlotte and he worked with Greg Valentine. Valentine come into the dressing room. His chest was split open, man, like three different places, maybe four places. Wahoo chopped him so hard. Valentine said, this Indian's going to keep this up. I'm going to get cancer on my chest.
That's how hard he hit, man.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't a joke, man.
He was, don't think he wasn't tough, man.
Oh, man.
Tough.
Yeah. He whooped those tough people. He was more than tough. I mean, oh, what a great guy.
Yeah, if he liked you, man, you with us. He was nothing but great things to say about Wahoo.
Yeah. All right, what about Charlie Smith?
Well, wait a minute now. Let me throw one in on Wahoo. I was his bail bondsman.
You what?
I was his bail bondsman.
Oh, really?
I got called one night to go to Tim Woods. I never was in Tim Woods' bar in my life. I never went in there. But I got called over there one night because Wahoo was chasing Norvell Austin around with a shotgun. I called Randy one night to go get Wahoo out of jail because he had, I forget what he did that night. They caught him for drunk driving or something in Hapeville. I sent Randy to bail him out that night. And Randy took him back to get his car, again at Tim Woods' bar. And Randy said, follow me, I'm going to show you how to get back to your apartment without going through Hapeville. Randy turned left, and when he did, Wahoo blew the horn and went straight back through Hapeville. And then one other time, Him and Dick Slater came out of a club there on Stewart Avenue, and they got in an altercation with some people. And Wahoo had been watching so many of them detective things, he thought you could take a butt of a gun and hit somebody in the head and knock them out. He hit this guy in the head with a gun, and the gun went off, and he shot Dick Slater in the leg. So we kept that out of the newspaper. So we were fortunate that it went through the meaty part of his leg, and he didn't have to miss no time. But there was never a dull moment when Wahoo was around. Okay, you can move on now. I just thought
all
I'd
right,
throw those
there
in.
There we go. Charlie Smith.
A man that never was at a loss for words and loved the wrestling business as much as anybody.
Yeah.
I got a lot of acquaintances I've come across in the wrestling business, but when you talk about true friends, Charlie Smith's on that list with me. There ain't a day of the week goes by I don't talk to him. And I travel with him. We stay together when we're on the road. And he don't want you to know it, but he's a sweetheart, and they don't come no better than Charlie Smith.
Ain't no doubt.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the other end of that then. Ole Anderson.
Ole Anderson. I'm going to give you my version of it. As hard-nosed as he was, he's one of the few guys I enjoyed working for, because I always knew where I stood with Ole.
There you go.
I'd much rather have somebody tell me to my face than, you know, have to worry about what they're saying when you're not around.
When I worked for Ole, I'm not saying Ole and I were good friends. I mean, he was everybody's boss, and I respected that. But I never had any trouble working for him. I knew I had a job, and he knew I was going to be there. I had a long talk to him about that time. He said, "I never worried about you." He said, "I knew you was never going to give me any trouble." He said, "You never come in doped up. You never come in drunk. You never complained about your money or nothing." He said, "I never worried about you." So that, I can't say that's my opinion of Ole. I enjoyed working for him. That's Jerry Oates' version.
I kind of echo that. I worked in the office. I had a little different perspective of him because, you know, working for Barnett, sometimes me and him was at odds over things. We didn't always see eye to eye. But the one thing that I agree with Jerry, you always knew where you stood. There wasn't any gray
areas. Yeah, there was no BS with him, Bobby, was it?
There was no gray areas. You knew what he thought. You might not agree with him, but you knew what he thought. And, and you share your opinion. You know, if you can ever get through Ole Anderson and get to Alan Ragowski, he's a funny, he's witty, he's charming, if that's a good way to put it. We rode together some, made some trips up through West Virginia together, and God knows you better like who you with up there. He was a good guy. He was funny. But getting through Ole to Allen is it don't happen very often.
No.
You knew where you stood from a business perspective, and I'd much rather work for somebody or with somebody like that than I had them tell you one thing and then do something else. And I never had you never had that problem with him.
Well, you put it right. He was Ole Anderson, not Alan Rozowski.
Yeah. When he wrote his book, I told him one time. I wrote his book, and he was very. He told me, we were talking about it, I'd read it, and I told him, and I said, "Well, I saw some things different than you did." He said, "I put in the front of that book, that was my opinion." And I said, "I agree, it was your book, your opinion, you voiced it." And he told me, he said, "If you ever write a book, you can put your opinion in it." And I said, "I agree, got no problem
with
that."
That's Ole Anderson, Bobby.
I said, "I have no problem with that."
That's Ole. And what's wrong with that?
Nothing. Nothing whatsoever.
That's it. Harley Race.
Well, I've already stated what I thought of him.
Yeah.
Some of my most enjoyable matches. I enjoyed being in Japan with him, and he was another guy that I never saw anybody Harley didn't get along with. Did you, Bobby?
No.
He got along with everybody.
meanest white man I ever met.
He was that, brother. Don't think he wasn't.
Yeah, he was sadistic man. I mean, he had a side of him that, buddy, he could be cruel when he wanted to be.
But you would never know that.
No,
you know?
Didn't. I mean, you didn't. No.
About Ronnie West.
Ronnie West was as nice a man, and he is right there, him and Bobby. I wouldn't put one past the other as far as their abilities for what they did for us in the ring, for the business. I wouldn't put one above the other. And so both of them are at the top, in my opinion, at what they did and how they carried themselves and what they did for what we did for making our living. That's my opinion of him.
He was one of my mentors. I learned a lot from him. Just watching.
He was unbelievable.
Just watching him. And, everything he did was, there was no wasted motion. He always knew where to be, when to be, and just fun to be with, too. Love riding with him.
Gordon Soley,
there was Gordon Soley, and then there was the rest.
Yep.
People try to compare Jim Ross is the best. There was nobody. There was never, has been, or will be another Gordon Soley.
No.
There could be two guys out there in the match actually stink, and he could make you, he could talk his way through that thing, but you actually just saw the best match of your life.
Mm-hmm.
That was Gordon Soley. He would come up with stuff that was just, I mean, like I said, it's Gordon Soley, then you figure out who you think's the best after that, but there will never be another him. That's Jerry Oates' opinion. I put that in my book when I write it, Bobby.
Yeah.
All right, here's a couple for you, Jerry. Elf Nolans.
Elf? Somebody from Oregon. Where did that come from?
That's one of mine. I've heard stories about him for as long as I've been in wrestling.
Have you ever heard stories about me and Elton?
No.
I guess I can tell it now. He's dead. His brother's dead. Elton was something else. That was John Owen's brother. Elton, he liked to tip the bottle, you know. And he was cantankerous, you know, so. I told Jesse and Johnny Eagles one night, we was in Eugene, Oregon, I said, he ran that town. So I said, I'm going to get Elton when he comes in here tonight. What are you going to do? I said, y'all just sit here and watch. So I got me a razor blade out, and I fixed it up. So I'm sitting there by the door. It was a small dressing room there. So Elton comes in. He's talking to Jesse and Johnny. Yeah, he said, you're right, keep quiet there tonight, Southern boy. I said, yes, sir. So I'm just thinking about my match. Yeah, that's good. So I took that razor blade, started at his knee and ran it down about to his ankle. Now, his pants, one leg is laid. I put him a vent in there, and he didn't know. Jesse Ventura is going berserk. I can't believe it. So when he walked out of there, he looked like he had some new style of clothing in France. His pant legs had vents all the way around. He gets up in the ring. He's the ring announcer, right? Well, guys are going berserk. So that was on, Wednesday night, Thursday night. So Saturday night we're in Portland. And Don's not going to be there. So Elton's going to be the ring announcer. So Elton comes in our dressing room, takes his coat off, hangs his coat up. I get my little gimmick out again, and I on his coat, right where your elbow bends, I put him a vent from about 5 inches down from the shoulder, down through the elbow, about 5 inches from the wrist. I did it on both sleeves. So he's got a card in one hand, you know, go read the card, and the microphone in the other. When he does that, both elbows shoot out of his coat. And the
oh. Oh, you can't have fun like that anymore.
No. So the first time I met
they were called the Kiwis up there.
Now, I'm talking about Luke Brown and Butch Miller.
Oh, the kangaroo. They were the.
What was it called?
First, they were the Kiwis. They were the Kiwis in Portland.
What were they called later on? What were they called? I can't.
The Bushwhackers.
Then they were the Bushwhackers. Then the Bushwhackers,
The first time I met Luke Williams, he said, "Hey, mate." He said, I've never met you, but I heard all about you in Portland, you and Don Owens. Oh, that was unbelievable, man. Elton Owens, he was all right. You know, he was Don Owens' brother. He was all right. He'd pay you to the penny, though. He had like $95 coming, you'd get $95.18. He paid you to the penny.
That's good. Oh, let's see here. Dick Murdoch.
Oh, man. I love me some Dickie Murdoch. That's another one I couldn't wait to get in the ring with. Dickie's timing, and for a guy his size, there's nothing he couldn't do in that ring. And you talk about our business was supposed to have been about trust and taking care of one another. I'd do anything he wanted to do.
Yeah. He was great.
I don't know if you ever had the pleasure of working with him.
No, I met him a few times when I was just a kid and started.
He was a character. He had his funny ways about him. Bobby knows what I'm talking about, but when it comes to business, he'd do business, wouldn't he, Bobby?
Yep.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Funniest thing I ever heard was Armstrong telling the story about in Atlanta when Armstrong said he got the heat up on Armstrong, and Armstrong got ready to do the comeback, and Armstrong used to do this, judo stuff, you know.
I know what you're going to say.
The judo stance. And he went into that judo stance, and when he did, Murdoch just reached out and shook his hand. And Armstrong said the comeback was over.
That is him.
Dusty told a story one time. Him and Murdoch were flying somewhere, and they had to land the plane to get some fuel. And when they landed, the airport was closed, and the pumps were locked. So you know they're out in the middle of nowhere. He said they had to get some gas, and he said so they decided to break into the little building there to see if they could find the key to the pump. And he said they broke in there, and Dusty said he was looking around trying to find the key, and said Murdoch hollered, said, "Dusty," said, "I think we need to leave." And he said, "Why?" And Dusty came back around the corner, and he said they didn't see nothing. He said, but on the floor there was a water bowl for a dog. And he said it was the biggest water bowl he had ever seen in his life. And he said, if that dog's that size, we don't need to be here. So he said they left.
I can't imagine what all they did.
If these are lies, Dusty told them. He said they were on the road somewhere, and he said there was a chain gang on the side of the road. And they were on the way to make TV or something. They had suits on. They stopped the car. Murdoch got out, went back up there and told the guard he was with the Department of Corrections, and he was there to inspect the troops. Had this guard standing at attention, and he had these prisoners up there with these shovels and stuff. He was inspecting them, and they said the real guy showed up. So he said they did that one time. He said another time they were going down the road, and somebody was having a family reunion. And he said they stopped and got down there and just got in line, started talking to people, made them a plate, left.
Yeah. Billy Travis would do that. He'd crash weddings, family reunions, company picnics. It didn't matter. Here's a couple for you, Bobby.
All right.
Bill Bowman and Joe Turner.
an absolute joy to have worked with in the ring, but more so now that we're out of the business, just being my friends.
Yeah.
I have very few wrestling pictures or wrestling memorabilia things around my house that are actually sitting out where you can see them. But one of the things I have in my dining room is a picture of me and Bill Bowman. One of the, what I consider one of the dearest friends I got in this world. And I just two super, super guys.
Just don't ever talk about Joe's brother-in-law and you'll be all right.
Just don't talk about his family. Yeah, he'll get hot. Oh, God, that poor guy.
Oh, here's another one for you, Bobby. The Sheik.
He was a remarkable piece of talent for what he did for so many years, for people to still believe that and to buy it. And he was feared by the fans. As far as a human being, I had no use for him. When he passed away and I was reading about all this remarkable, wonderful, charitable good stuff that he did, that wasn't the fella I knew. And my mama says, if you can't say something nice, don't say nothing at all. So we'll leave it at that.
Here's one for both of you. Tommy Rich.
A kid that was given the world and didn't know how to handle it.
Everything that happened to him was self-inflicted. He had the world handed to him and didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah. Nice guy. Never had a crossword with him. Never had a problem with him. Still see him from time to time. And he was given the world, and he didn't know how to handle it.
I don't think until years later did he ever realize how over he was.
Oh.
I don't think until it was over with that he realized, you know, what a star he was on Channel 17. I mean, he was the first national guy that just, I mean, he was on every magazine. He picked up from 78 to 84. He was on the cover of almost every magazine.
Well, he should have realized what he was making.
Yeah.
And as far as talent, he wasn't that talented.
No.
He drew the teeny boppers.
Yep.
I was there at the beginning. I was refereeing Atlanta TV. He came down from Nashville, Tennessee to do a job for Abdullah the Butcher on TV. They always sent two or three guys from Nashville. And they sent some good guys down here to work. First time I ever met Buddy Wayne, he came down to do a job on Atlanta TV for Abdullah. I had met Jerry Barber before, but Jerry Barber came down to do a job on Atlanta TV. Some good guys came down. Tommy came down one Saturday, and Barnett happened to be at the TV station, and Barnett saw him. And Barnett went to Ernesto, and he says, do not put that kid on TV and kill him. Have him go out and sit next to Gordon on an interview that somebody else is doing. So don't have him say a word. Don't have him open his mouth. Just let people look at him. And Barnett went home, called Gulas, did whatever they did to cut the deal to get him down here, and that's how it all started. And Jerry's right. From a pure talent standpoint, he wasn't the greatest worker in the world. He did not have a great body. The gym was the farthest thing from his mind. And
you have any idea how far he could have gone if he'd have listened to guys?
Oh, geez.
He came in the TV one Saturday. I said, man, what are you doing at Kmart Pluto? He like the wet with the work. I got along with Tommy. You know, I just, at the end, I felt sorry for him, man.
Yeah.
He had it handed to him.
They would have put that strap on him for an extended run if he had just went to the gym, if he had just carried himself a little better, and he had stayed off the junk.
He couldn't do it. He could not do it.
No,
he just... And it's sad.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know. I wish things were different for him.
Yeah, especially seeing him now. Man.
Yeah.
Man, oh, man.
Do you ever run into him, Bill?
I saw him right before Christmas. You know, I was on the first, when he came back, he disappeared there for a few years, and he came back and worked Dundee. Dundee ran the Legend Show in Jackson. And me and Bill were downstairs when you come down to Coliseum there, Jackson Coliseum, in the hallway, and we just threw some people out in the hallway, made them leave, and Bill looks up, and we see this guy coming down the stairs, and Bill said, "Go throw that hillbilly out of here." And I walked over there, and when I got to him, he said, "Hey," and I realized it was Tommy Rich. And Bill starts yelling, "Is that Tommy Rich?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "There's no way." The sponsor from the car lot that helped put the show together, she wanted Tommy on it. She would not believe that was Tommy Rich. She thought we'd found a lookalike or somewhat lookalike.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can he still get around?
He hobbles, but I tell you, he works as hard as he can in the ring. You still get a match out of him.
Yeah.
You know, and people still get with him. But it's just, I mean, it's not what it was.
Bo, I know we ain't got much longer, but give me an update on Union City, Tennessee, please.
I have not heard anything else. I look every morning when I get up, I look at the news sites that we're covering to see what has happened, and I've not heard anything else. So I will keep everybody updated on that deal, because it's still, I've never heard nothing like that. So
I've been in the game a long time. I never heard nothing like that.
Not at all. So, Bobby, where you got service for Easter Sunday at?
We're having our sunrise service at the Pentecostal church there in the neighborhood. We have a community sunrise service where we go to a different church every year. And then we'll be just having morning service there at Friendship and taking Sunday night off. So,
give them the address for Friendship.
678 Gaskell Street, southeast in Atlanta. And it's very easy to find. It's in the old historic Cabbage Town area of Atlanta. You can ask anybody where that's at, and they'll point it to you.
Yep. We have service 10:30 Sunday up here at Calvary Baptist in Kingsport, 1238 Pine Street. Me and Misty will be home to make it to our home church this week. So, and anybody come around Kingsport area, just ask for the village.
Do y'all sell gimmicks at your church there? You advertise you're going to be there? You have a gimmick table?
No.
You know? Oh, I just wondered.
No, I'm not Charlie Smith. So.
Listen, the Sunday that Soto came, he could have sold autographed pictures, I'm telling you.
He sure could have. I'd never seen people line up outside the church to get the picture made with somebody like that.
I heard that. I mean, and then out of all the people that was at that Ted Allen show, he got the biggest pop.
He sure did.
So it was a...
He was a working fool, man.
Yes, he was. Oh, he's...
What a dropkick.
He's still funny, too.
Oh.
Well...
You just don't go out to dinner with him, you end up in the hospital.
Listen, he's sitting at the reunion. This woman goes and dumps her tray behind him, sets the tray down, and she rubs her hand on his back, and she says, "Hey, Roberto, how are you?" And she walks away, and Roberto goes, "Was she saying hello, or did she wipe her hand on my back?"
That's him.
Jerry, when does the tour season kick up down there where you're at?
We got spring break right now, Bo, and it's just it's strictly entertainment, man.
Oh.
You can't believe what you see. It's amazing what alcohol does to people.
Especially coming, that's coming from somebody that grew up in the wrestling business.
I'm telling you. I'm telling you. If I could video this, we can make a fortune.
Oh, goodness. So, well, guys, I enjoyed tonight.
I had a lot of fun.
We had it funny, educational, and I think everybody learned something tonight.
I hope so. I learn something every week.
Yeah. working on some guests. I got to get back with Handsome Jimmy. I'm going to have him on here in a few weeks, and I'm working on Tracy Smothers and George South and a few other people we can get on here, and we can just talk about the way it was.
Sounds good.
They can't take our memories away from us.
That's for sure.
So we will be right back here next Thursday night, 8 o'clock. Hope everybody listening joins us. Tell a friend.
Have a blast, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Good night, guys. Have a good week.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
We thank you for listening to the Tribecast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.